Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
The Human Zoo, where they don't hide away the sick animals.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the great dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Stand to attention when I'm talking to you!
On Talk Radio.
Yes, mess!
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's a big day in the United States today as Democrats and Republicans prepare to turn out in record numbers to either give a massive boost to Donald Trump or attempt to put the brakes on the presidency that has divided a nation. We'll bring you all the results as they come in later on tonight. And it all seems to be very, very, very finely balanced on a knife edge at the moment. Georgie Frost joins me today. We're kicking off with adoption and just why people are so loath to adopt children these days. The number of people adopting children has fallen by two-thirds in the past 40 years. And in the same period, successful IVF treatment has risen by 29%. I'm not sure if the two things are related, but we're going to see if we can find out precisely what that all means. 0344 499 1000. Would you adopt a child in this day and age, in this current climate, or would you not? Coming up, we'll be finding out why the National Trust thought it was a great idea to cover up a load of male sculptures with sheets in an art gallery, and why the new Doctor Who has lost a quarter of its audience by being too PC. Plus, we'll be asking whether capping energy prices is actually a bad idea, because Georgie's not keen. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, and Georgie Frost on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, 0344 499 1000. Georgie Frost is here with me. A TMU says, absolutely incredible. Loads and loads of people adopt animals, and you see people talking about it, sharing things about it, and more charities being supported. But for children, it seems different. Should it be? There must be a reason why. Well, we've always known, I'm afraid, that, you know, certainly when I was in the newspaper business, you would get far more money raised if you were trying to raise money to save some animal than if you were actually trying to raise some money to save a child. Because people in this country are far more willing to help animals than they are to help children. Yep. And that's part of the problem.
Of
the fact that there are so many kids who are not being adopted because there's not enough people who want to adopt them. 3-1 is the current situation where there are 3 children for every 1 adoptive parent, which means you're never going to get rid of the backlog of kids who need a decent home.
I know we know that animal charities get a lot more funding. I know people want to give money to animal charities, but I don't necessarily think that there's a link between people necessarily more likely to adopt a dog over a child, given that a dog's probably going to last,
evidence,
I don't know, ballpark
but the evidence is there. I mean, obviously, you're adopting a dog because you can't actually have a dog. You know, clearly there's a difference, but the point is that...
Yeah, but the two aren't necessarily correlated.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is people are far more willing to be more helpful to animals in this country than they are to be helpful to children. It's as simple as that.
They tend not to come with so many issues, and they tend not to last as long.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's anything to do with that. I'm just, my point is that, you know, as he says, people are willing to adopt dogs, they're willing to give money to dog-type charities. What they're not willing to do is adopt a child. Of course, it's a much different situation.
Huge
but,
difference.
You know, it's an interesting point to make.
Of course it is.
Now,
we
let's look at something that's going on in Northumberland, which has been drawn to our attention. It's a 3-week exhibition that was in a National Trust property, the home of Lord Armstrong, a place called Cragside, okay? Now, they've got a load of sculptures in this place, a load of paintings, and you can go there, pay your money, go around the stately home and look at all the wonderful works of art. The problem is, right, that the people that run the trust up there decided it would be a good idea as part of their celebration of women and power that they would actually cover up any piece of art that had involved the depiction of a man, i.e. if it was a painting that was a painting of a man, or indeed if it was a sculpture of a man, they threw a sheet over it so you couldn't see it. Absolutely unbelievable, a PC correctness, ridiculousness. Let's talk to Manik Govinda, freelance art correspondent, find out what is going on out there. Manik, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Manik.
Thanks very much for joining us. It's mad, isn't it? I mean, occasionally you see something in the newspaper and you just go, yes, the world has gone officially mad. Let's try and see why they ever thought this was a good idea.
I mean, yes, this is absolute idiocy.
Right.
You know, if it is about celebrating the centenary of the women's vote and the suffragettes, this is pure nonsense. I mean, the whoever you know is responsible for this really needs to do some history. This is a building in the late 19th century, and Lord Armstrong's bequeathment, or the National Trust kind of looking after this building. It's a 19th century building with 19th century artwork.
Yes.
Of course, most of the painters in those days were men. We all know that. So what kind of finger-wagging lecturing is going on here?
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
What is it? Is it the fact that you don't... I mean, because this is political art, right? I would assume this is with the argument here. So is it the fact that you would agree with this generally, but just not here? Or is this the world gone mad?
Well, I think it's insulting the public's intelligence. People are paying to come and to do a visit, to this National Trust building. It's a family day out. And
why insulting their intelligence?
Well, I think... as soon as you start to lecture the public in this high-handed way, by covering up artworks that were made in the 19th century to make a point that women are invisible, that they were excluded in artistic life as well as political life or social life, then it just felt like this is something that a school child would learn in secondary school or primary school, if they're studying the Victorians. We all know it was very prurient. There was a real kind of high morality around it. Women should be seen and not heard. And but the kind of virtue signalling and just telling people that men were more dominant in the 19th century, I think we all know that.
But actually, a lot of people won't know that. And next to this sort of stark covering, well, they might not know that, right?
You can't go through life assuming people are complete and utter buffoons, surely.
No, not at all. But the point of this was to cover up artwork just to prove how, as you say, Manik, how hidden women were in that life, both in society and on canvas. And Manik, as an arts correspondent, you have to agree with that. Women were largely excluded from a lot of artwork, from a lot of those people that, the painters and the artists themselves. And actually, this is to highlight a point. And a lot of people won't know. I wouldn't know until I realised the whole of this house is covered. And I don't agree with that because I'm a National Trust member.
Surely if you go to a National Trust exhibition expecting to see pictures of men and pictures of whatever was being depicted at that time, you would be reasonably well connected with the arts world. You would probably know that there are not very many women in the pictures because they weren't generally drawn. But to cover something else up...
Link.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, lots of ignorant people that go to the National Trust exhibits and know nothing about arts. Do you?
Another way to do it, they could have gone around this, is to actually have a public talk about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Have a guided tour.
Yeah.
Looking at the artworks. Figures, of women and young girls, and that's part of a particular period of history. So, yeah, I think you can enlighten people by actually opening up a discussion around that period. But
How would you do that? Because it's very difficult to do that.
Well, you can. I think there's a lot of guided walks that happen in public museums and galleries, and so.
But they're not going to make the papers. And whether you agree with this National Trust thing or not, it has actually highlighted a point and put the National Trust in the press for good or bad.
This is the catch-all get-out clause for anybody who ever does anything stupid. They go, this was supposed to be to stimulate debate. It wasn't at all to stimulate debate. No. They didn't think anyone would notice, and they thought it'd be quite cool and clever because they're all students. So these are the same sort of people that decide that wearing a poppy is a bad idea.
Of course, that's the problem. Thought people would notice. That's the whole point.
I don't think this is
a PR exercise, surely.
No, sure. I mean, people should have demanded their money back. It sounds
exactly.
like it caused a lot of anger. And people feel patronised. It's like what happened at Manchester with the J.W. Waterhouse painting, Hylas and the Nymphs. There's a massive backlash when people, an art curators removed the painting and said, "What do you think?" So the public were furious about it. It backfires and doesn't do good to any cause that you're trying to highlight. And if it is about women's equality, 100 years later, let's talk about what the achievements of now, not you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
In the
90s. I mean, these are the kind of movements that are talking about removing statues from places. You know?
I know, but
it's
exactly
the same kind of mentality, isn't it?
To a certain extent, I agree with that, but I do wonder if this says less about women and making a statement and more about the National Trust trying to be relevant to the next generation.
Well, that's a good point. And I think the National Trust, you know,
because they've been embroiled in controversy before, haven't they?
They have, yeah. And I think the National Trust is trying to be relevant to the 21st century, but, you know, to look at historical buildings and historical figures through the lens of the 21st century is, you can pick everything. You know,
yeah.
You might as well just knock down the whole building.
Well, exactly. I mean, funnily enough, it's the kind of thing we saw ISIS doing,
yeah,
knocking down temples and blowing up the Taliban, blowing up temples and those wonderful cave statues in Afghanistan, because, you know, it doesn't fit with what we want to do now. Mm. Well, I'm sorry, the National Trust has a responsibility to actually help educate people in our history, not to change the history.
Yeah, we have to look at it of its time. These are buildings of their time. They are beautiful buildings. They're very opulent, and they're wonderful places to visit. And I think there's great pleasure to be had by looking at the past. You may not agree with everything that's there, and certainly, you know, with paintings and artworks, one's curious about what that figure is. You know, if there's a little girl selling oranges, what's that about?
Mm.
Was she a poor girl? Was she so it does open up history. It opens up history of that period. Not all the paintings are great. You know, there's quite a lot of vanity paintings at that time of people like Lord Armstrong and Lady Armstrong. But these were philanthropists,
industrialists. Right. And it's his art collection, effectively.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know,
with Turner,
sure, he'd be delighted
that
you know, they're all covering up his art collection that he donated for the good of the country.
But Manik, I just want to ask you, because Mike, you spoke about there, you know, you made that link between ISIS, and obviously that's a big leap towards that. But however, Manik, what are you making of these stories that keep coming up? And I was thinking of the one in Southampton where the Students' Union was covering up pictures of white males in, you know, World War One. What are you making of the way that modern society is now looking back at artwork and almost trying to cover it up as though this didn't happen?
I think there's a kind of loss of authority in the cultural and academic institutions. It feels that curators and directors almost wanting to kind of say, well, let's just give you the voice, and then the invited artist or students and so forth are kind of given free rein to play around in this kind of performance intervention.
I think they maybe need to start taking their history a little bit more seriously. Maybe we need to start teaching history better in the classroom as well, in schools. I think there's a large responsibility there. Somehow these kids are coming out of school thinking that, you know, well, certain things are not acceptable anymore.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be allowed to talk about them.
We're abdicating responsibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sounds like this is maybe it's good that the student wasn't named, but it's mentioned that it was a student's project.
Yeah.
And if I was a lecturer, and I do mentor a lot of young artists, I would really question the reason why this, you know, this intervention. Why do something like this in a National Trust building?
Yeah, yeah, it's really...
You know, ask a lot more questions and get them to really rethink what they're doing sometimes.
But yes. Manik, have we not seen this sort of behaviour in the past? Some sort of hundreds of years ago, I think, wasn't the Roman, the church in Rome, didn't they get very funny about certain male genitalia? You know, there was very puritanical kind of views in the past in which we've seen artwork covered up.
That's right. And, you know,
we don't go back to that, do we?
Enlightened kind of period now,
yeah.
You know, very progressive. Mm. We've had the sexual revolution in the 60s, and that's changed, you know, people's attitudes around the nude in art. And so we shouldn't be going back to this kind of neo-Victorian values where, you know, are we going to start covering the chairs and table legs, ridiculous.
Absolutely mad.
Petticoats, you know.
I know. Crazy. Manik, listen.
Who knows where this will go, but it needs to be stopped.
It does need to be stopped before it goes any further, I think. Manik, thanks very much indeed. Manik Govinda, freelance arts correspondent there, talking about the craziness of what the National Trust got up to up in Northumberland. We're going to talk to Ryan now, who's in the New Forest, wants to talk about history. Ryan, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Ada.
Yeah, very well, sir. What do you want to say?
It's basically about the taking for granted that everybody in the world is an idiot. Oh, I do that myself, but I do that because I just prefer to do that. But for a society to do that is very, very, very wrong. Like you're saying about the, you know, I need to know about the suppression of women during the 18th century and 19th century, do I? Well, I only do if I look it up, and I need to, because surely society moves forward. You're meant to look forward as you walk forward, not look backward, moaning about whatever's just gone on, and you walk backwards into something. I mean, it just seems like a stupid situation.
All right, then what do you think about us celebrating the centenary of the First World War on puppies? Should we look forward on that
one
and not look back?
Well, we're commemorating it, aren't we, rather than celebrating
it? Well, what this is commemorating is the work of Women in Power programme related to women's suffrage. So it's commemorating the work that women's Lib did for getting us the vote.
Is that what they were doing? By covering everything up?
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Okay.
They're just doing it in their way to market.
Sorry, Ryan, I'm not following this one. You could perhaps explain it to me.
Oh, I don't feel that's not commemorating the suppression of women or women's role, is it? I mean, if you're going to look at that, you'd probably look at the things that women managed to push through during that suppression and then highlight that rather than applying modern thinking to an old, to an old infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, it come from the ground up and we're looking at it from the top down, and it's not going to, you're going to get different perspectives and different views, and it's not going to give you a good, you know, actually, you're not actually going to know how it's happened properly. People won't understand how we've got to where we are if we're looking at it from an unjustified sort of view. I mean,
yes.
You need to...
Well, I agree with you, Ryan, because what covering up things does is covers them up. It doesn't actually reveal anything. Therefore, by its nature, it doesn't stimulate debate. It just tells you that something in a long time ago was somehow different. It doesn't actually explain what it was.
But, okay, if you take it from the view that it is covering it up, or you could take it from the view, and what you were talking about a little bit earlier about ISIS and all this thing, how we need to get rid of things that happened in the past that we don't agree with, right? That's one side of it. Or you can say that this is political art in and of itself. And therefore, what is the point of art? It's to stimulate debate to a certain degree.
Covering up art is not art.
So is this, in and of itself, this is saying it's using art... I'm not saying it is, but that's what people will argue, that we're using this sort of art now to stimulate debate. And are we not debating the issues?
Well, no,
right?
Because the issue doesn't need debating. You don't have to debate whether or not women were subjugated in the 18th century. As Ryan says, if he wants to know about that, he can find out about it. He can learn about it. It's a fact. It's not debatable.
Hang on, I thought you said that we need more education and history in schools. So you're saying that the only way
you
we should find out about history is by looking at it for ourselves.
No, yeah, but that's true. But you're missing my point. My point is you don't debate whether it was right or wrong. You just say this is what happened. The problem with what we have nowadays, and I think Ryan will agree with me, is that everybody's debating everything. You don't need to debate whether women should have the vote. Of course they should have the vote, but they didn't have the vote at a time when they were thought to be second-class citizens. That's not a debate, is it, Ryan?
But it's talking about the role in society.
I feel that also what we're in danger of as well is that we pull back the draconian views from the past by looking at it this way into modern society. So therefore, we're sort of putting the modern society, I'd never have suppressed women.
Yeah.
What a pathetic thing. And then we're going to drag the views from a load of men from 100 years ago and apply them to the thinking of this day and age and say, all men are predators. Hashtag me too. Watch out for all this. I mean, it's a stupid way. That's what I'm getting. I'm annoyed that the approach is so stupid from our society. Not necessarily that it's right or wrong. It's just... stupid.
Yes, I agree with you. I think you're absolutely spot on, Ryan. Thank you very much indeed. Ryan made a lot of sense there from the New Forest, as he often does. The point is that, you know, we've got to this point by debating things. You don't have to debate absolutely everything. I mean, it's different when you have a radio show in which you debate everything.
Why
but
not?
In life, I'm not interested in my children going to school and debating whether or not it was right for them to subjugate women in the 19th
but
century.
But that's not what they're arguing, whether it
was
right.
Are.
What they're showing
that's what
is
they do now.
The role of women
in
society in that time was hidden.
But the point is that they need to teach in schools that was the role of society. Right?
So we don't think... hang on a minute. You don't think we should be debating issues? Children should be
shown
facts
know.
De facto and that's it and learn them and not explore whether those facts are presented in a way that's
they
the
can
point
explore
of history
them, but
though.
You don't debate whether it's right or wrong. Like, for example, they don't need to debate whether slavery was right or wrong. They just need to know that it happened, because the problem is you've got people debating stuff they know nothing about, because all they're thinking about is, well, was this right or wrong, but they don't actually have any facts to back up either side of it. My point is that you should go back to teaching history in a way that history needs to be taught, which is about what happened in the past, not why it happened.
No, that's I think you're completely wrong. I did a history degree. History is, yes, it is about stuff that happened in the past, but it's also about looking at things from different angles. Because let's be honest, there is not one truth.
How is history looking at things
if
from
Donald
different
Trump
angles?
Trump was to say, and we're going to be talking about this a little bit later, if he was to decide what's written in school books, and he probably could be, then that is
why
what generations will know for years to come.
No, but the point about what's written in school books is it should be factual. It shouldn't be opinionated. It shouldn't be this was right and that was wrong.
But it's not
and
about
this is
right
what you're
and wrong. It's about exploring.
Yeah, but that's the way it's being taught now.
Often all we've got is primary, secondary sources. Now the further things go, it's secondary sources.
Oh, okay.
So you need to work out what is the thinking of those sources.
So what you're saying now is you don't
them...
trust historians. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you should always be dubious about sources, the same way you should be when you're reading the newspaper. Don't just take things at face value. That is what you learn in history. That is what you do as a job.
So all the history that I learned when I was at school about Henry VIII, that was all just rubbish, was it?
It's a load of sources. I'm not saying it's rubbish. It's not saying it's rubbish at all. But it's about the historians that took sources and removed sources that they didn't think were relevant enough or didn't think were accurate enough and presented you with something. And you, as an intellectual being, should have the responsibility then to go and question it, to learn a little bit further.
No, my children are not at school to be intellectual beings, right? They're at school to learn about history. I don't want them to learn about whether the history they're being taught was right or wrong. I want them to learn about the history. Then when they're a bit older, they can talk
about
whether it's right
history.
Or wrong.
It's about the sources, about the presentation. We all know
no,
the way
you see,
things
you are a good example of what's gone wrong with our education system. You've got a history degree and you can't explain history to me.
I've just explained history to you.
You've completely confused the issue.
Not at all.
Yes, you have.
How are we supposed to know about what happened in the past?
Because you find some historical document, right?
Who do you believe?
Like the Magna Carta.
Who do you believe?
Is that all made up as well?
Who do you believe?
What do you mean, who do I believe?
Who do you believe? So if Donald Trump says this is fake news.
Well, Donald Trump isn't history yet.
But in 100 years' time, they're going to look back. Who do you question? You know, his inauguration? Do we question what he says about it? Or do we look at the other
stats
as well?
You can look at film in that case. That's fine.
You can do now.
Yeah.
Right?
So
but you
that's
can't
not
in
a problem
past.
Then,
and
is
even
it?
The past, if you take a
oh,
look at
there's a big
of
empty spaces over there. You
lot
can
of
see the
Russian
film.
Pictures during Stalin's era, they washed out people who were in the picture, right? So you need to have multiple sources to say, by the way,
well,
this
that's why good journalism is quite handy in
there
these
you
matters,
go.
Right?
So well, what's journalism then?
Journalism
surely
is reportage.
Surely it's presenting the facts.
It is
how do you get to
the
facts?
Facts? Well, I've been a journalist all my life. I know how to present facts, thank you.
Okay, but how do you get to the facts?
Well, you get to the facts by being there.
Do you believe, so a person
and,
comes
and,
off...
and not sitting behind a desk and writing about something that you're watching on a TV screen.
Okay, you can't
you
always
actually go
be there.
No, of course you can't.
You.
That's my point. So when I go back to Henry VIII's time, I don't know anybody that was actually there to ask, okay? So I have to rely on the historical documents which are replacing my ability to be there, okay?
Yeah.
And that's what I want my kids to learn in school.
Okay, the documents, but the documents aren't going to tell you sort of what sort of a guy he was like. It's not going to tell
well,
you
the
anything
writings
that's...
are going
it might
to
tell you
that.
About his stats, his... The writings, absolutely. And as is this the writing that was perhaps commissioned by Henry VIII to write a lovely kind of hagiographic
there's
view
enough,
of him?
There's enough
or is it going to be a real,
no,
real document? So
there's
you
enough
as a
information. No, there is enough information... At any one given time that you can coagulate together, right? And this is exactly what the problem is in schools now. People like you telling kids all of this nonsense, so they don't know
question
what to believe.
Question things, kids. Question
no,
things.
No, you can't question everything. That doesn't get you anywhere when you're 14 years of age, for heaven's sake. I'm going to have to call in for some kind of emergency, heart starter, I think, soon. 03444991000. We're going to talk about Donald Trump and the midterm elections. Believe nothing that you hear from this woman to my right. This is Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
On my left, watching America. On my left, there's panic in America. Oh, 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 there's trouble in America.
Now, I think it could legitimately be said, regardless of how he is viewed by history, that Donald Trump's referendum is today. It's the midterm elections. It's halfway through his presidency. And of course, there are people in the United States of America who think he is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And there are other people who think he's a ghastly, terrible, awful representation of a man who has completely and utterly divided a nation. We're going to talk now to Dr. Simon Radford, a US politics expert, to find out what he thinks is going to happen tonight, because, Georgie, it's going to be very close from what we're told. It's going to be quite a big turnout, we think, on both sides. There's an awful lot of races in various states, particularly in Arizona, which are pretty much neck and neck. Dr. Simon Radford, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. Is it right to say that it is a pretty close run at the moment, and really we won't know until the results start coming in?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of polling in the lead up to the races which point in one direction, and certainly parties have begun to sort of anticipate what the results might be. So you have both races for the House of Representatives and races for the Senate. The Senate seems to be fairly close, with a few different races kind of maybe swinging the balance possibly towards either a good day for the Republicans or a good day for the Democrats. In terms of what the Republicans are saying for the House elections, it looks as though they're resigned to perhaps losing the House of Representatives to the Democrats. And
question
is, how bad will the damage be?
Right. And how, as a judge of these things, will it be? I mean, when you say that if they lose the House of Representatives, you know, how bad does it have to be for it to be a disaster for Trump, if you like?
Well, I guess it depends on the lens you want to take. So, obviously, Donald Trump is going to be concentrating on the Senate because it's going to look rather better. So when he goes and speaks to the nation about the results, he's going to say, you've put your trust in me, the Senate has stayed in Republican hands, and will totally ignore what happens to the House of Representatives. What's maybe interesting is what the Democrats can do with a majority in the House. So it can stifle his agenda domestically quite a bit, and they can start launching investigations into the White House, which I'm sure we'll all be interested in finding out what they might uncover. Not that there haven't been investigations ongoing since the day he was elected, but there's certainly going to be some costs to President Trump in losing the House.
What is the issue among real Americans at the moment? I mean, is this about Trump? Because he's not even on any of the ballot papers.
It's just
papers,
him, really,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah.
You know, anyone looking at the papers would think we've gone back a few years. We've got Obama talking. You know, we've got President Trump, even though he's not even on the ballot papers. Why is this so significant? What are the real issues the Americans are debating at the moment?
Well, I guess there's a question of how much of this is just a referendum on Trump, and so is it really about a man rather than about policies? But in terms of policies, I mean, it's interesting because depending on who you speak to, there's a great economy, everything's going very well. And therefore, you would think that considering the Republicans have the presidency, the House and the Senate, that should play to their favor. But I think people are also still upset about corruption in Washington, D.C., about incompetence, about the system. And the part of the problem with the Republicans, who've been running for years and years on being anti-establishment, is they are the establishment. So if you are annoyed and you are fed up with how things are going, there's only really one party you can blame. So that's kind of been one of the interesting things in terms of this. The other thing, of course, is that it's been kind of, you can draw parallels with the Brexit vote, that the economy is doing very well, but in specific parts of the country. So if you go to San Francisco, house prices are still colossal. You know, Silicon Valley is still spewing out dollars. If you go to rural areas, or you go to ex-industrial areas, you go to sort of seal towns outside of Pittsburgh, or you go to rural areas, they're not doing so well. And these were the people really who powered Trump to victory. So it looks as though, for example, in the Midwest, which shocked the world by going for Trump rather than Hillary Clinton after she didn't spend really enough time campaigning in them, places like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, they seem to not to have stuck with Trump this time, at least judging by the polls. So kind of the question is, I guess, is how much can they have the Democrats have an economic message which speaks to these people to say, you know, recovery, what recovery? You've been left behind.
The problem the Democrats have got, though, is they don't really have a figurehead, do they? I mean, even now when I speak to my friends in the States and say, you know, who on earth is going to run against Trump if he does decide to go for a second term from the Democratic side? There isn't really anyone emerging as a kind of front runner at this point, is there?
Well, in 1984, when Reagan was extremely popular, they had seven Democratic candidates. They were called the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
And nowadays, you've got the kind of the internet, which can mean that you can raise money from all sorts. And it's not just a case of, you know, sort of your backroom boys with cigars kind of collecting checks. It's kind of much
No, but you still need a face, though, don't you? And there's no face as yet.
You do. Part of the problem is that so many people think they can run that the attention is split 100 different ways.
Uh-huh.
If there were really two or three people who were viable, then we'd see a lot more kind of concentrated publicity on those two or three people. But as it is, you've got Cory Booker, you've got Elizabeth Warren, you've got Bernie Sanders, you've got maybe Joe Biden running again, you've got Kamala Harris. So there's a whole number of names which... I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are like, who are those people? And that's because we've kind of, you know, you might have read one column about one of them, but you're unlikely to know so much about all of them that you're kind of really sizing up who your favourite is.
Indeed.
We're hearing a lot, aren't we, that a lot of there's many more people who've pre-registered. Those who are able to vote have already voted. You know, the young vote as well, women getting engaged. How much do you genuinely think that's going to translate to the polling booths? How engaged are Americans in this?
Well, there's one thing which is true universally about Donald Trump, and that's everyone has an opinion. No one's bored by the idea of Donald Trump. So whether you are a Democrat who is, you know, sort of utterly narked about the very idea of Donald Trump being president to begin with, or whether you're part of the Trump base who thinks that he's been sabotaged and maligned, you're motivated to vote. And one of the interesting things about midterm elections is normally, a bit like they say that Labour does better here when the turnout's high, and the Tories tend to do better when the turnout's low. In America, the Democrats tend to do better when the turnout's high, and the Republicans tend to do better when the turnout's low. You saw people not turn out for Hillary who did turn out for Obama, particularly African-American voters, particularly Hispanic voters, particularly young voters. And normally, in the midterms, those voters are less engaged because there's less publicity, there's less kind of money being spent, there's less national coverage. With all the Trump circus, there's certainly enough coverage. There's certainly people motivated to spend money trying to get people out to vote. And there's certainly sort of a bit more natural enthusiasm than there was in 2014. So we'll see. It certainly seems that sort of judging, as you said, by the early votes, that there are more people voting than the equivalent time one cycle ago, 4 years ago.
No, indeed.
And whether it translates is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing. And, of course, unfortunately, for those of us who are trying to predict what might happen, the polls have got it so wrong in the past, particularly the last presidential election, that you don't really know whether you can even trust the polls. So, like I said, I'm wondering whether you can't really know anything at all until quite substantially late on tonight and some of the early results start coming in.
Well, as someone who you know used to do some polling, it's the part of the problem is that you have to model turnout. It's pretty easy to find out what people think about whether they favor the Democrats or favor the Republicans. What's harder to find out is whether someone's motivated to turn out and vote.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
whether they tell you what they're actually thinking, or whether they tell you what they think they'd like you to know that they think.
Well, there's that too. There used to be shy Tories, and there used to be people, especially when there were African American candidates in the United States.
Yeah.
Who would say they'd vote for them and then secretly wouldn't.
Yeah.
It was called the Wilder effect.
Mm.
And there's similar things here. I mean, I think what's interesting is that because people have moved, you might find the occasional shy Trump voter in Los Angeles, and you might find the occasional shy Democrat in Alabama.
Right.
But mainly, all the Republicans live in Alabama and all the Democrats live in
right.
California. So there's it's separated out more than it used to be. But what we don't know is...
Although a lot of places voted for Trump last time around that wouldn't have voted a Republican in the past, you know? So he's kind of torn up the rule book in some ways, isn't he?
Exactly. So a lot of non-voters will have showed up to vote, just as there are a lot of people who used to vote who decided to sit on their hands because they didn't like either Hillary
right.
or Trump.
Right.
So working out how you model the participation, how you model what the likely voter turnout looks like depends on, you know, what the polls might say it's 52-48. But actually, if a lot of those ones who are 52 decide to stay at home and a lot of the ones who are on the 48 decide to show up, then all of a sudden that the script can be flipped.
Yeah.
So it might well be that the pollsters have underestimated Democratic support because they've underestimated how angry the Democrats are. It might well be, too, that they don't realize quite how motivated the Trump voters are to show up and support the president.
Yeah.
So I think be a couple of percentage, or 2-3% out either way, but that can make all the difference when you're looking at tight races like the Senate and the House.
No, of course. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Simon Radford. We're out of time, unfortunately. It's going to be a very exciting night. You can hear it all as it happens, of course, right here on Talk Radio.
Feel like a woman. The girls need a break tonight. We're gonna take the chance to get.
This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Matthew Wright coming up in a little while. Sarah's tweeted us. She says, I heard from my friend who's Lithuanian yesterday that the government actually are in control of their heating. I was shocked they can't turn the heating up and they can't turn the heating down. A bit worrying, isn't it?
No.
It's a bit like that when I lived in New York. In New York, right, they have this steam heating because, you know, when you go to Manhattan and you see the steam coming out of the ground. You ever seen that?
Oh, a la Marilyn Monroe dress?
Well, no, that was just air from the subway.
Oh, right,
this is actually steam. I mean, you don't want to stand on it. But, I mean, basically, you sometimes see a funnel in the middle of the street in Manhattan and there's steam coming out of it because the whole of Manhattan is underlaid with steam pipes, right, which basically heat the entire city. So when it snows there, the street's actually so hot that the snow melts very, very quickly and very rarely sits for very long. And all the apartment buildings are heated by steam heat. So you don't actually ever have to pay to heat your home.
Well, there you go.
Very smart. You see, the Americans have got these things right. So there's any number of things that they could be doing in this country. They could build an entire new community with steam heat.
Steaming country.
Steaming country. And then you don't have to pay for electricity at all.
Yeah, that would upset Scottish power. But that takes innovation. It costs, you know.
Well, you know, the Americans did it, you know, I think the last century or the one before. So anyway, let's talk about time travel because it's time for Doctor Who and time for Mike Ward, who is the Daily Star's TV critic. Mike, a very good afternoon to you.
Hi, Mike.
Afternoon,
well,
Mike.
Doctor Who has lost a quarter of its audience and apparently it's got nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman.
No, well, I don't think it has.
No, I didn't say that in any ironic way. I said it because it was true.
Yes. Yeah, well, the figures, I mean, I would. The only thing I'd say about the figures is we don't entirely know whether it's entirely sort of reflective of how it was compared to, I don't know, 5 years ago, because viewing habits change and all the business about iPlayer and catch up and blah, blah, blah. But I, for one, have turned it off, and I don't think I'm alone by
Why?
Any means. Because I find it, and I know people have been going on about this, and I don't want to be obvious about it, but this whole ham-fisted PC nature of the storylines is just excruciating. Yeah. It's not so much the topics that they're choosing to cover or even the message they're sending. It's the way it's done. It's as if it's done for people with you know CBBC age.
Okay, for those people who haven't seen them, just explain what some of the most controversial perhaps moments have been.
In the Rosa Parks incident. This is based on the real life story of Rosa Parks, who in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1955, famously refused to give up her seat on a segregated bus, and it stirred up all sorts of race issues, and went down in history. And it's an important message and lesson in history. But the way it was done, it was so ham-fisted. And you've got this one character, the character Ryan, who when he realizes they travel back in time, they met this character, this woman, Rosa Parks, for real. Oh, you're one of my heroes. I grew up being told everything about you, and it's such an honor to be with you. And you think, okay, fair enough. And then at the end, you've got Jodie Whittaker's character, who sort of sums it all up, and she sort of ties up the loose ends by saying, and what happened after this, guys, talking to her companions, was this and this. Yeah. I think, well, hang on a minute, this your companion has just said this woman is a hero of his family's, so he should know more about it than you do, but you have to sort of conclude the show with this sort of slightly
patronizing. I was saying to Julie Hartley Brewer earlier on today that I have a sense, and I don't know if this is in any way true, it's just my theory, they don't want her fighting aliens anymore as the Doctor, because that might be sort of drawn as some kind of anti-immigration scenario.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. I mean, I think this is how these people think.
We've had an episode with a sort of very heavy-handed sort of Donald Trump-alike character. We've got one coming up about... which is set.
Has he got tiny hands?
Oh, 1940. The next one is set in 1947 in India, obviously, the time of the partition.
Oh, for God's sake.
And you just think, week after, it's ticking boxes.
Yeah.
As I say, I don't mind, over the course of a series or several series, to take inspiration from these important historical events, and nobody's denying their significance. But it's like every week It's like going to school.
But also, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when they had that little Scottish kid in the kilt and they went back to the Battle of Culloden. Yeah. But they didn't give you a big sort of history lesson on exactly who was in the right and who was in the wrong. They just sort of went mad to dodge people, you know, trying to kill them with claymores.
I think the problem, it's because you've got this sort of diversity agenda, and that's all important as well. I don't have a problem with that, but what I have a problem with is that it seems to be taking priority over other things.
Yeah.
So it's like, let's tick that, you know, diversity box.
Where does that come from?
If it's entertaining, it's just the BBC.
But like recently, what's changed? Because of course we always had, you know, we had Christopher Eccleston, Dave Tennant, Matt Smith. They always used to get around 8 million viewers. So it's really dipped. But hasn't the BBC always had pretty sort of agenda that's like this?
Well, I think it's from people I speak to, it's sort of prevalent on a greater scale. I mean, people I know produce radio shows who, for example, are being told what guest they should have in, and it's not always based on who's the most informed guest, put it that way. Uh-huh. And we
don't do that here at Talk Radio, of course. That's why we're so popular.
I just think, you know, nobody's objecting to the actual points and the thinking behind this, but do it, don't... It's just a laborious...
Well, it's a bit like social engineering for television people, isn't it? Which is wrong.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be entertaining.
Yes, please, treat us with a degree of intelligence,
really?
And we can learn stuff, and we can pick up, you know, we can go away and look into these issues and perhaps learn more about them than you can tell us on Doctor Who anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
And come to our own conclusions, but don't sort of ram it down our throats in such an obvious, clunking,
Well, I hated it. I saw, when I was in the cinema with my kids, and I saw a trailer for Doctor Who, which immediately incensed me anyway, because I'm thinking, well, why are the BBC spending my money on putting out an advert on the cinema screen, in which she said, I just like to help people.
Yeah,
and I just went, oh, really? Why don't you just kill a few Cybermen instead?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But anyway, Mike, we're out of time. Thank you very much
indeed.
Mike Ward, Daily Star's TV critic.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.